Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was recorded on Monday, November 10th, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we're hosting a special CERT Alert telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, as I mentioned, we're hosting a special CERT Alert telephone conference call discussing the Halbig, King, and BP cases. We have a CERT grant in the CERT and the King case and a CERT petition in the BP case. Other than being important cases at nearly the same stage in the procedural process, however, these are unrelated cases. But given the fact that we're crunched for time on the eve of our convention, we thought we could host a single telephone conference call and discuss both cases at the same time. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of our two experts of about 8 to 10 minutes in turn, and then we'll be turning to the audience for questions. Professor Jonathan H. Adler is the Johann Verhey Memorial Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. He's going to be discussing the King and the Halbig cases. And then we'll hear from Professor John S. Baker, Jr. He's visiting professor at Georgetown University Law Center and professor emeritus at the LSU Law School. And he'll be discussing the BP case, including his recently authored paper on the same case. And with that, Professor Adler, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. It's a pleasure to be here today. Somewhat unexpectedly, to be talking about the court's grant of certiorari in King versus Burwell, an important case challenging portions of the Obama administration's implementation of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. We've done some teleforms on this case before, so I'll briefly just say what the case is about and then say a little bit about the CERT grant. The case is about whether or not the IRS may provide tax credits and by extension cost-sharing subsidies for the purchase of qualifying health insurance plans in exchanges that are created by the federal government. The reason this is important is because the Affordable Care Act, as it was passed, envisioned that states would create health insurance exchanges, but it turns out that about three dozen states declined to create their own exchanges. But the statute, which provides for tax credits for people between 100 and 400% of the poverty line for the purchase of qualifying health insurance, provides that those credits are available for the purchase of insurance in exchanges, quote, established by the state. And that language appears multiple times in the relevant provisions, and it turns out was added at multiple different points in the drafting process. The position of the IRS and the administration is that despite that language, tax credits may be authorized and provided for people in states without regard for whether or not the exchange was established by the state or established by the federal government. The plaintiffs in this case and in three other cases that are pending in various courts maintain that the IRS rule is unlawful, and one of the reasons they've raised this concern is because the availability of tax credits triggers enforcement of the employer mandate penalty, so the penalty that employers can face for failing to provide adequate health insurance to their employees, triggered by one of their employees being eligible for tax credits. And then further, the individual mandate penalty, that is the tax penalty that individuals pay if they do not themselves have qualifying health insurance, that penalty is contingent upon there being insurance for that individual that is affordable in relation to their income. So the availability of a tax credit makes insurance more affordable, and therefore, for those who wish not to purchase health insurance, it exposes them to a penalty that they would not otherwise have been exposed to. So that's part of the basis upon which various plaintiffs have demonstrated standing in these cases. There are four pending cases. The case that the Supreme Court accepted cert on is King versus Burwell. In that case, a panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit upheld the IRS's rule. Two of the judges concluded that the language of the act was sufficiently ambiguous, that the IRS's rule was a reasonable interpretation. One judge thought that, in fact, the law properly read requires providing tax credits in all exchanges without regard for whether they're established by the state or the federal government. Another case, the one that has been getting the most attention up until this point, is a case called Halbig versus Burwell. In that case, a divided panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit held 2-1 that the IRS rule was unlawful. The court held that while federal exchange may satisfy the other requirements of state exchanges, an exchange established by HHS is not and cannot be an exchange established by the state, and therefore the IRS rule is invalid. One judge dissented, arguing that the agency should have prevailed under Chevron deference. That opinion and the Fourth Circuit opinion were both, surprisingly enough, issued on the same day. Federal government filed for a petition for rehearing en banc in the Halbig case. The D.C. Circuit granted that petition and was scheduled to hear the en banc case in December. I assume the D.C. Circuit will hold those proceedings in abeyance, but I'm not aware of any action being taken by them on that point. The other two cases, really quickly, there's one in Oklahoma, filed by the state of Oklahoma by Attorney General Scott Pruitt. In that case, a district court in October held that the IRS rule was unlawful, and there was an appeal pending in the 10th Circuit. And then in the fourth case, this fall, oral argument was heard in the district court in a case in which the state of Indiana and several Indiana school districts challenged the same IRS rule. In terms of the granting of cert, what was interesting is that if all we are concerned about is the existence of conflicting judgments, that is, two court judgments that are in place that conflict with one another, there was no circuit split, because when the D.C. Circuit agreed to rehear the Halbig case en banc, under D.C. Circuit rules, the judgment is vacated pending the en banc proceeding, although interestingly enough, the opinion is not, just the judgment is vacated. But if one looks at one thinks about circuit splits as really being about whether or not different courts, when the issues have been aired, come to different or conflicting rationales or understandings, then it was certainly clear that this was a question that was dividing federal courts. The D.C. Circuit and Fourth Circuit had disagreed. A district court in Oklahoma had disagreed. On top of that, our Supreme Court rules have always provided for the granting of certiorari in cases in which there is a significant question of federal law that is or should be, or is likely to or should be resolved by the Supreme Court. And I think a lot of commentators felt that this was certainly a case that raised that sort of an issue. It raises a very important issue in terms of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. It's an issue that certainly many folks care a lot about. In fact, the day of the conference in which the Supreme Court first considered petition for certiorari, several members of Congress had an op-ed in the Washington Post defending the IRS rule. This is a matter of strategy. I generally think that getting members of Congress to write an op-ed in the Washington Post on the day of a Supreme Court conference is probably not a good way to convince the court that it's not an important case, but that was done, and the court did grant. I also, in this case, there are arguments, I think very strong arguments, that time was of the essence. If the plaintiffs are correct, and I'm certainly on record as arguing that the plaintiffs are correct, then the result of a judgment in their favor will be somewhat disruptive, in that the IRS had gone ahead and implemented a rule that it did not have the lawful authority to do, and that many people and many states relied upon the lawfulness of that rule. And the longer that the rule remains in place, the more that individuals obtain insurance believing they have certain tax credits, the more insurance companies are making their offerings under the assumption that people have tax credits, the more that states are making decisions about how to be involved with the ACA implementation based on the assumption that the IRS rule is in place, the greater the reliance interest, the more disruptive it would be to reach such a conclusion. And I think the court was probably motivated, at least in part, by a concern that this was sort of question that is best resolved as quickly as possible, and that lower courts had effectively aired the relevant issues. And I should note that some other commentators have pointed out that it was somewhat odd for the federal government to raise no objection to appellate courts fast-tracking consideration of this case up until this point, as both the D.C. Circuit and the Fourth Circuit had, but then to suddenly argue for en banc rehearing, which would drag out the proceedings, and then suggest the Supreme Court should not offer quick resolution. As I think Professor McFadley at Michigan pointed out, and generally disagrees with me on this case, that it's kind of hard to argue the case was so important that it merited en banc rehearing, but not important enough to command the court's attention. Last point I should make is some suggest that, especially in the absence of a circuit split, a vote to grant certiorari indicates that the court is likely to reverse. The quip that is usually made is that the court doesn't grant certiorari to affirm. As someone that has written extensively in support of the theory that plaintiffs' cases are based upon, I certainly like that interpretation, but I think it would be premature to read too much into the grant of certiorari. I think there are other reasons why the court could have granted. This is an important question. It does raise some significant questions of statutory interpretation, in particular statutory interpretation against the backdrop of what all agree was a poorly written and rushed through statute. And given the potential reliance interests at stake, I would not necessarily assume that four justices are ready to overturn the Fourth Circuit. I think the most we can say is that at least four justices think this is a serious question that was worthy of their attention at this time. And I will stop there and turn it over to John to talk about the other case.
Thank you, Jonathan. Jonathan, you did a very good job on that, and it'll be hard to even equal it. The case that I'm dealing with is extremely complicated, as the Fifth Circuit noted. It's one of the most complicated class actions in history. And so trying to boil it down and make sense of it in 10 minutes is not going to be easy. The description that was given to you in the blurb that went out talked about the fraud in the case, and certainly that's an important part of the case, but the real issues are to do with Article 3. And so what I want to do is try to first boil down some of the background and then go into the fraud issue, secondly, and finally discuss the constitutional issue on Article 3. As we all remember, first in 2010, the BP platform exploded in the Gulf and dumped all this oil, and we had nonstop coverage after that. BP immediately announced that they were setting up a $20 billion fund to pay damages. And they did this in one sense voluntarily, and in another sense Obama twisted their arm. But in either event, they were very anxious not to be put in the position that Exxon was in the Exxon Valdez fiasco some years before. The problem they found is that the voluntary fund, although successful after 9/11, didn't work the same way in this kind of a disaster because you had deep-pocketed defendants, and we know where there are deep-pocketed defendants, there will be lots of litigation. So there were lawsuits filed from all over the country, and ultimately these were consolidated in the Eastern District of New Orleans, in Louisiana, that is in New Orleans, under the multi-district litigation provisions. And that went on for a while, and the key part is that ultimately the parties, that is BP and the designated lead attorneys for the plaintiffs, came to, quote, a class settlement. And then they filed a class action. And I'm not sure how many people understand that a class settlement, class action, is really different from a normal class action. That is, it is filed with the expectation that it is immediately settled. The settlement comes first, then the plaintiffs file, and as in this case, they settled the case and filed the settlement within 2 days of filing the action. So I want to emphasize the fact that this is all about class settlement. Well, the second point is that after the settlement, then the settlement blew up, just like the BP oil platform blew up. And why did it blow up? Well, you might give various reasons, but there was a provision, a quite extensive provision on how the payments and to whom the payments were going to be made and what proof of causation various businesses in various locations had to establish. And for some areas, there was already a presumption of causation. That is, for businesses right along the coast, in those areas, they really didn't have to provide much of any proof. But in other areas, they were supposed to provide proof. The settlement unraveled when the court-appointed administrator started paying out claims that BP said should have required proof of causation. And the administrator claimed that he was simply following the settlement agreement. At that point, BP starts litigating its own settlement. And this is where it becomes procedurally very complicated. There were separate parties who had objected to the settlement all along. And they filed both in the district court objections, and then they filed an appeal to the Fifth Circuit. Then BP didn't object to the settlement, but they objected to the way it was being administered, and they filed. When they went up, their opinion came out first, and it was a 2-1 opinion, a 2-1 judgment, but in the lead opinion, Judge Clement, often found at Federalist Society meetings, ruled not only in favor of BP in sending it back, but raised the Article III issue that frankly had not apparently not been raised by BP at all. That case goes back, and while it is resolved one way, not resolved, but by the district court ruling in a certain way, BP disagrees, and they appeal again. In the meantime, a completely separate panel, but with one member of the first panel, the dissenter, on the second panel, they uphold the class certification. Then when the original panel, with Judge Clement and the dissenter and the other judge, deal with the issue again regarding the administration of the settlement, it flips from 2-1 one way to 2-1 the other way. Judge Clement goes from writing the first opinion to writing the dissent. Then there is a petition for rehearing en banc. Judge Clement writes the dissent to that, and what's really notable about it is that she says that because her colleagues, a majority of the Fifth Circuit, refuses to straighten out the mess of two different cases, two different appeals that should have been consolidated as one but were not, that, quote, the court itself has become party to a fraud. What was the fraud? The argument, as I've already mentioned, was that these claims were being paid out, which shouldn't have been paid out. But let me just quote something from the opinion, which also appeared in a New York Times piece. BP has been forced to pay, quote, hundreds of bogus claims, claims like that to the, quote, wireless phone retailer who was awarded more than $135,000, even though its building had burned down before the spill. And an attorney who was awarded more than $172,000, even though his license had been revoked before the spill. So those are the fraudulent claims or examples of them that amount up to, I don't know exactly how much. I don't think BP knows how much. But in one sense, it's small relative to the billions of dollars that BP is paying out. But it's not unimportant to the federal courts and whether or not they're going to allow such a fraud to go through. So that brings us to the third point, the Article III issues. BP is not challenging the settlement. They are picking up on Judge Clement's argument that because there were fraudulent claims included in the class, that the class cannot properly be certified because there are people in the class who have no standing because they were never injured and it doesn't meet the three-part standing test. broader issue, which I've raised, which the parties have not raised, to some extent the objectors have, is that it's a class settlement. There was no real litigation. Therefore, where is the case in controversy under Article 3? Now, most of what I've written relies on a book by Professor Martin Reddish called Wholesale Justice. And as he says, many class actions are just fine, but in a class settlement action, he contends they are inherently unconstitutional because they are filed not for the purpose of litigation. They're filed with only a purpose of settlement. So there is never any adverseness. Therefore, it doesn't meet the case and controversy requirement of Article 3. I, of course, agree with Professor Reddish, but so far the courts have not really picked it up. If BP gets its case accepted, it'll be considered by the court on Friday. What's really peculiar about it and what will possibly hurt BP is that it purported to take up the two different Fifth Circuit opinions, that is, appeals, that is, the one on the administration and on the one on the certification. The difficulty is that on the certification, they never objected to the certification, and yet they've included that in their cert petition. On the other hand, if there is no case or controversy, federal courts on their own are required to note that and dismiss the case if they find such a situation. The issue will be whether the case is so convoluted that the court doesn't want to touch it, or whether it is so significant because of the size of the class settlement and the fact that class settlements are not normally taken up, that it may consider the case. That's where we stand. We'll know next Monday what the outcome of the petition is. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you both, professors. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 200 people on the phone, just one question so far. After this question, our lines will be open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, it's Eric Clays from George Mason Law, and this is a question for Jonathan. Should people read anything into the fact that the Supreme Court granted cert on a Friday? When the court has conferences on Friday, I think it's more regularly the course that the any orders that are voted on Friday are then reported and announced or released on the Monday after.
I think that's a good question. And my view on that is really dependent upon comments that have been made by other court watchers, including some of the Supreme Court reporters and folks at SCOTUS blog. What they have pointed out is that in the fall, it is more likely, you are sometimes more likely to see grants announced on a Friday rather than a Monday, and that's usually a question of scheduling. So, for example, one reporter noted that since this case was to be argued in March, that making the announcement on Friday works out better than waiting. That seemed like a plausible argument to me. I can't really see any other reason. I know some people have raised some political questions about that, but I don't understand why the political impact or significance of an announcement on Friday versus Monday would mean much. The other comment that's been made that I at least found interesting was SCOTUS blog suggested that one reason the court, that if the court knew it was going to take this case, one reason to make sure it was scheduled in March as opposed to April would be to make sure there was enough space for gay marriage, which I think at this point everyone believes the court will be taking and hearing in April due to the Sixth Circuit's decision rejecting challenges to laws refusing to recognize same-sex marriage. And those are the opinions that have been expressed by folks that follow these sorts of things more closely than I do. They seem like plausible explanations to me, and you know, I just can't see any big political significance in why the court would announce this grant and the other grant that was made on Friday now as opposed or you know, Friday as opposed to Monday.
Professor Baker, do you have a comment here? Should we go to the next question?
Go to the next one.
All right, here we go.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you. This question is for Professor Adler, and this is Steve McCloskey. I'm an attorney in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Jonathan, I was wondering, I believe I had read that the term established by the state, quote-unquote, had been used not once but several times in this 2,000 or 2,500-page law. It seems that if it were a Scrivener's error, it may have been used once or twice, but can you speak to the number of times that, quote, established by the state, unquote, has been used throughout the legislation?
Oh, sure. I guess we did a little bit. And whether or not it shows Scrivener's error or whether or not the phrase is in and of itself significant, I do think is a bit more complicated. But to begin with, the observation that the phrase established by the state, this is not a phrase that simply appears once. It's not a phrase that even simply appears once in the relevant provisions, that is Section 1401, which creates Section 36B of the Internal Revenue Code. This phrase established by the state actually appears twice explicitly in 1401 and then is cross-referenced seven more times. And we know from looking at the various iterations of the legislation as it developed over time that established by the state was not added at the same time. That is, initially there was one reference to established by the state in Section 1401, and then when the Senate leadership was going over the bill in preparation to introduce it on the floor, it was added again, replacing what had just been a reference to exchange and the relevant section numbers. The phrase established by the state was added. I think that's significant because if the drafters of the statute in the process of drafting replace A plus B, exchange with reference to a section number, with A plus B plus C, it is reasonable to presume that the addition of C has some non-zero significance and that the two phrases are not in fact equivalent if that substitution is not made throughout the statute. And in fact, it was not made throughout the statute. There are some places in the statute where, in fact, the sorts of revisions were made were the reverse. And Michael Cannon and I talk about this in our most recent amicus brief from the Howbig case. The phrase established by the state does appear in other parts of the statute. The government has argued that when you look at those provisions don't make sense if established by the state actually means established by the state. I mean, there are a couple comments. One, it's tempting to say that's irrelevant because as the Supreme Court has held in multiple Clean Air Act cases, the same word or phrase need not mean the same thing in every part of the statute. But I don't think we need to make that argument because every provision that the federal government points to, there are, I guess, four or five where the phrase established by the state is used, one where the phrase established by a state is used. The difference is really a function of the grammar of the provision, not any significance beyond that. All of those provisions are provisions that are seeking to ensure coordination between the state and federal governments, state exchanges and other entities, or induce state cooperation. And insofar as they are directed at the states, they actually only make sense if they were referring to state-based exchanges because the federal government doesn't need to legislatively encourage the federal government to cooperate with the federal government, particularly when you're talking about operations within a single agency,
yeah.
And certainly wouldn't do things like, say, this is part of how you ensure that you're complying with Medicaid, which some of those provisions do. I mean, it would be insane, if not unconstitutional, to say to a state, you lose your money unless either you cooperate or we happen to get around to fulfilling various administrative tasks the statute has given us. The second
right.
part of that turns what might be coercive or might be troublesome for other reasons into something that is just completely unfathomable. So I think when actually one looks at the statute as a whole, one doesn't find a work of art. But one does find a degree of consistency and rationality that reinforces the plain text meaning of the relevant provisions.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Thank you, Dean.
You're welcome. We've got one question pending, and then our lines will be open. Let me ask a question for Professor John Baker, if I could. I'm looking at your paper here, and there's a quote that you used in your opening remarks from Judge Edith Clement. And now I'm reading from your paper. She indicts, quote-unquote, a majority of her Fifth Circuit colleagues' refusal to review the fraud, saying that, and here you're quoting from Judge Clement's opinion, "Left intact, our holdings funnel BP's cash into the pockets of undeserving non-victims. These are certainly absurd results, and despite our colleagues' continued efforts to shift the blame for these absurdities to BP's lawyers, it remains the fact that we are party to this fraud," close quote. And I think "we are party to this fraud," she's indicating the, her fellow judges. Is that, how often, and maybe Jonathan Adler has an opinion here too, how often does a circuit court judge use language that's that striking?
It may be because she's a friend of Justice Scalia that she's picking up on some of his tough language. No, I mean, that's most unusual. I can't think of anything. Jonathan, can you?
I think it's certainly rare. I mean, do you occasionally see strong language from judges? Sure. Judge Edwards, in his dissent in Halbig, certainly uses some strong language. But it is unusual, and I think it is the sort of thing that could attract attention. If while I have the floor, if I could ask John a question, now I'm just curious about with regard to the BP case. Some commentators have suggested that this court seems to be very sympathetic to arguments that the law should facilitate non-judicial ways of resolving disputes,
yes,
so arbitration and,
right,
and things like that. And I'm just wondering whether or not this case kind of, or how you see that case fitting into that theme. Might that be a reason why the court would find this case particularly interesting or particularly worthy cert grant insofar as it might enable the court to make it easier to, for example, create settlement mechanisms of the sort that BP had sought to create?
Well, Reddish's point was that in the Amchem case, which impliedly endorsed this kind of thing, he says, although it's somewhat tenuous, he said the court left the question of Article III for a later day, which, I mean, you don't really leave Article III for a later day and encourage lower courts to do this. I mean, that seems very odd. The problem with the case is it's all messed up. On the other hand, because it is such a big case and because it is so difficult to get to class settlements, if there are four justices worried about Article III and what class settlements are doing in the way of using courts for purposes that they're not intended to be, that is, effectively what the court has become as an administrative agency. Now, we've done that in schools and hospitals and prisons, yeah, but is it going to turn itself into an administrative agency here? I don't know. I can see the court taking it because of that significance and what you're talking about as well. On the other hand, the case is so convoluted that it may not want to touch it.
Is Professor Baker, is BP arguing that if the case stands as it is, that future defendants will be much less likely to try and reach settlements?
Well, first of all, BP is arguing that there's a conflict with other circuits and there's a dispute over whether there is or isn't a conflict. And that's a big part of the problem in the different Fifth Circuit opinions. Ken Feinberg filed an amicus in which he argues that unless this kind of settlement is upheld, it will discourage these kinds of things in the future and will undercut, the kind of work he does. In part, you know, some have charged that what he is arguing for is simply in his own self-interest. Again, you know, one can have different opinions. Feinberg was the one who administered the voluntary fund initially, and then that was closed down when they went to this other multi-district litigation settlement process.
Let's turn back to our audience. If you've got a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines are open.
Professor Adler, my name is Ron Calder. I'm a healthcare attorney in Sacramento. I've been following this issue ever since you and Mike Cannon fired a rocket up in the air to get everybody's attention early last year. My question is whether or not the court accepted the case because they may want to look at the Chevron deference issue again.
You know, it's possible, and I would be skeptical of that. I'm one of those folks that thinks the court that most of the justices on the court really do not have a fully fleshed out set of priors or principles in administrative law cases. I think that's true in statutory interpretation as well, such that I would not think they would focus on that. I don't think the cert petitions necessarily highlighted that. There are some interesting Chevron issues in the case that the court could reach if it wanted to, but this to me is not an area of law where I think there's a majority of the court that really sees the need to clarify or clean up the doctrine and is in the process of doing that. There are quite a few, you know, while there are some justices like Justice Scalia who tend to be fairly consistent in Chevron cases, most of the other justices are not nearly as consistent in their approach, and so I doubt that is something that reached or piqued their interest. I do think you know, some have suggested, and I don't know if this is the case, but some have suggested that the grant of en banc in the D.C. Circuit made the court more likely to take the case in the sense that it looked like the federal government was trying to keep the case away from the court. I don't know if the court would have read it that way, but that's certainly been suggested. I also think it's notable that last term the court had two cases, UARG versus EPA, involving the regulation of greenhouse gases, and a case called Bay Mills Indian Community, in which the majority of the court in both of those cases rejected arguments that courts should ignore strict readings of the text that require each word to have meaning if it produces some result that's kind of unworkable or unfavorable or unwanted. In both of those cases, the court said, no, that's not how we do it. That there may be places in statutes where there is room for agency interpretation. There may be places where it's reasonable to find ambiguity, but you can't just pretend that clear phrases or clear words aren't in fact clear phrases and clear words, and you certainly can't deprive them of any meaning whatsoever. So, for example, in the UARG case, the Supreme Court said a phrase like any pollutant, depending on its context, might mean different things in different parts of the statute. It's not clear Congress was always paying attention about how that works, but when Congress gives a numerical threshold, we all know what a number means, and we've got to give a meaning to that. I think similarly in this case, there are portions of the Affordable Care Act where one could argue that the language is sufficiently imprecise that maybe the IRS or HHS has some wiggle room, but a phrase established by the state, when the word established is used in a consistent fashion throughout the statute, when the word state is defined expressly by the statute, when the phrase appears multiple times in a particular place, to come back and say, oh, that's just surplusage, or that's just convenient shorthand that is conveniently not shorter than what it is shorthand for, or that's just a hard argument to take seriously. And so that sort of thing might have piqued the court's interest. But I would be skeptical if the court is really interested in cleaning up Chevron, because I just don't think a critical mass of the justices have really focused on that enough to want to do so.
Thank you. We've got a couple questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Carl May. I'm in private practice in Cleveland, and this is also an Affordable Care Act question. I don't know what the record in the case is and how much the court's likely to go outside of the plain meaning in the statute, whether this is going to be a case involving searching for legislative intent, but there's a fellow named Jonathan Gruber, and this was reported in National Review Online just this afternoon, and it's been out there previously, who's apparently testified or stated that indeed it was intended that the only way you got the credits is if the state set up your exchange. So that was deliberate, is to force people and, into the state exchanges and to force the states to do that. Do you think that type of testimony or statements, and apparently he was one of the architects of the act, will somehow get in front of the court?
Well, it will certainly be cited. I mean, just let me make 2 points about the Gruber videos. And should we note that there are multiple videos. After the first one appeared, he said it was a mistake. And then another video in which he was even more explicit from a speech he'd given a few weeks earlier than the first one appeared. Let me say two things. One, it certainly affects the atmospherics, because Jonathan Gruber is credited with being the person that designed key portions of the Massachusetts healthcare plan, upon which key portions of the Affordable Care Act were designed. He is the author of many of the underlying theories that are used to justify why the law looks the way it does. Up until the federal government's en banc merits brief, the federal government had cited Jonathan Gruber in every one of their merits briefs, in every one of the cases with raising this issue. They had used his three-legged stool analogy. Suddenly, in their brief to the D.C. Circuit en banc, they no longer cite him at all. They no longer make reference to the three-legged stool analogy. So I think that it certainly affects the atmospherics that here is someone that is very influential, very involved with the bill, who articulated the rationale for why Congress might have conditioned tax credits as well as anyone else could. In terms of its actual legal relevance, I think we need to be a little more careful because this is an after-the-fact statement by a non-legislator. So it's not directly probative to what the text of the statute means. Its relevance is limited to showing that one of the arguments that the government has made, and that has been made by some of the judges that have accepted the government's arguments, are wrong. But it's important to stress that that's a very it's only legally probative for that limited purpose. That is to say, the government has argued, some others have argued, that it would be insane, completely irrational, completely inconceivable that any member of Congress would ever think to condition tax credits as a way of putting pressure on states to cooperate. And they've kind of argued that as a way of saying that any interpretation of the statute that leads you to that conclusion must be categorically wrong. The fact that someone of Jonathan Gruber's knowledge and influence could articulate not only that that's what the statute says, but also provide the rationale, shows that it was not inconceivable, it was not implausible, but rather of the various things Congress might have thought to do, this is certainly something that one could have thought that Congress might have done. So the Gruber videos are relevant for that limited purpose, but they don't, I think, speak to the actual plain meaning of the text. They just show that the plain meaning of the text does not produce the sort of absurd or irrational or implausible outcome that some have claimed.
Jonathan, are you working with the lawyers for the successful petitioner?
I mean, I've answered questions from folks. Mike Cannon, who has been my co-author on several articles relating to this, a very long article in Health Matrix, and then some shorter things, he and I have submitted amicus briefs before all the appellate courts. We are planning to submit an amicus brief to the Supreme Court, and our briefs have tended to try and summarize and highlight things that we found in our research, both for our initial article in Health Matrix, which is a very handy 80-page sleep aid for people that suffer from insomnia, but then things that we've discovered subsequently, because you know there are, even though I'm someone that does not think legislative history is all that probative and believe that legislative history is something that we have to be very careful with and certainly cannot supplant plain text, I do think it's an interesting inquiry, and I certainly recognize that other academics and some courts and some judges and some justices do think legislative history is important. So we've spent a lot of time just seeing what's out there. And so in our briefs, we've tried to say, you know, here's the plain text, and then here are some things from our research that, that show that the plain text really isn't problematic in ways that courts should worry about. But, you know, I haven't, you know, have not been, you know, retained by or directly worked with the plaintiff's attorneys, again, other than being willing to answer questions.
The reason I ask is, will you make that point you just made in one of your briefs, even though you think it's for a limited purpose, that is that the government has dropped or changed their arguments since?
I think that point will be made. I mean, Sam Kasman at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, who has been very involved in helping to arrange for or facilitate the King and Halbig cases, I know has made this point. The state of Oklahoma filed a brief bringing a group of videos to the district court attention there that I thought did a very good job of explaining the ways in which the videos were and were not relevant, you know, really kind of pointing out that they were for some purposes, it was for some purposes, not for others. But that point's been made, and I think the folks, you know, that are representing the plaintiffs are well aware that the government has suddenly changed both who they rely upon, but also the very language they use to describe the way the statute operates as a way of trying to distance themselves from Jonathan Gruber.
We've got about 10 minutes left. We've got one caller pending with a question. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next question.
Professor Adler, David Tryon here in Cleveland. Hi. So about a year or so ago, you gave a presentation to our Federal Society here in Cleveland and talked about this. You know, first of all, you mentioned just a minute ago about what Congress thought and determining what Congress thought, which to me always strikes whenever I hear people talk about that in connection with this. It seems like a meaningless exercise, especially in connection with Nancy Pelosi's statement that we have to pass law to learn what the law says. I mean, and nobody even read it. So what Congress thought seems irrelevant. It seems like they didn't think. So the only thing left to look at is the language. And you explained the language, you know, when you presented it to us, and I thought your position was, you know, eminently logical and almost incontrovertible. But then people in the media and other practitioners that were sort of on the periphery would say, well, that, you know, they didn't make sense, they said. So I'm kind of curious, with people who actually look at it in academia, if, you know, what kind of treatment have they given your theory of that? They, is it all over the place or mostly on one side or the other?
Well, I mean, of those that say things publicly, folks in academia have mostly been critical. The responses I've gotten directly have certainly been more mixed. I've certainly found a lot of administrative law folks who really have no strong opinions one way or the other about whether or not the healthcare law is good or bad, who think the plaintiff's arguments are very strong. Most of the folks that have been involved with this are folks that deal with healthcare generally, health law generally, and the vast majority of which were actually involved in promoting healthcare reform, urging it, and so on. There were several prominent letters supporting passage of the law written by prominent healthcare academics. So, you know, that's where most of the commentary on this has come from. The most interesting commentary, though, has probably come from some folks in environmental law that have argued that the sort of statutory interpretation urged by the administration here looks a lot like the arguments made by the Bush administration in Massachusetts versus EPA, arguments that incidentally lost, arguments made by the Bush administration in some other Clean Air Act cases in the D.C. Circuit and in some Clean Water Act cases in the circuit. So, for example, a case in which the Bush administration had argued that a total maximum daily load under the Clean Water Act really shouldn't have to be a daily thing. It could be some other period of time. That TMDL is just a phrase. It's a term of art. It's shorthand. It's not – the precise words themselves don't mean that in particular. And some folks in environmental law have said that that if the government were to win here, it would actually undermine arguments that environmental advocates have made quite successfully over the years in trying to hold government agencies to a strict reading of the statute. And perhaps the best or most famous example of this historically is a case called TVA versus Hill, where this big water project gets shut down for a fish, this tiny little fish that 3 years earlier no one had even heard of. And the court said, this may be crazy, but if it's crazy, Congress can fix it. This fish that no one cared about until they thought it could stop this project, meets the criteria of the Act, and the Act requires us to protect it. And in that case, Congress eventually fixed the problem legislatively. So I think that's been really interesting. I think a lot of folks who have strong policy reasons for defending the government here haven't really thought through how allowing agencies more flexibility with statutory text in one context could have interesting implications elsewhere and perhaps have implications that some of those same people might not like.
Thanks.
We do have another question pending. I think we probably have time for two questions. If somebody else wants to ask the final question, push your star button and then the pound button on your phone. Let's take another caller.
Thank you. This is Bob Davis in Portland, Maine. I'm not an attorney. The previous caller actually asked my question, so I'll change it slightly and ask, is it possible to try to limit the amount of credibility or importance given to legislative intent when Congress more and more doesn't read or even bother reading intricate statutes?
I think that's one of the bigger issues raised by this case is, what do you do with a statute that by all accounts did not go through the normal legislative process? If there's kind of standard hygiene for legislative enactments, this statute did not qualify because it never went through a House Senate conference, so there was never a point at which members of both houses of Congress really had the opportunity to make sure every provision of the bill did precisely what they wanted. Instead, the House had to accept the Senate bill and then change portions of it through reconciliation, but that's a very limited process. They couldn't go through that sort of process of revision. So the bill we got was, in many respects, a bill that no one wanted, and it did not go through the sort of process that usually leads to bills at least being a little more coherent or cohesive. My own view is that should cut against the government. That is to say, if a legislature deliberately chooses to pass something that's sloppy and not carefully vetted, then they should be stuck with that choice, because that act was, in fact, a choice that they made. My view is that the government's essentially arguing, well, let's pretend as if we enacted a statute in a more regular way and in a way that achieved things that many folks might have wanted. I just don't think that goes. And I certainly agree that this is one of several episodes relating to the Affordable Care Act, which should convince folks that it is important that members of Congress actually read the legislation they enact, and if it's not clear, make sure they understand it. I mean, all the members of Congress that are now saying the plaintiff's argument here is wrong also said that if you liked your insurance plan, you could keep it. So they've all shown that already that either they didn't understand the bill they voted for, or they were willing to deliberately misrepresent it. And I'm not going to say which I think is the case, but that's not what legislatures should do. Legislators should understand the legislation they enact, and if it turns out that that legislation was based upon premises that turn out to be false, such as in this case that states would cooperate, then it's up to the legislature to fix it, not for an administrative agency or for the courts to do the legislature's work.
But only the court would decide how much deference to pay to legislative intent.
I think here the way you judge, I'm with Frank Easterbrook in the sense that the way you determine legislative intent is you look at the text and you use the normal textual tools to interpret, to figure out what a text means. And the reason for that is that there were 535 intents. because there were 535 members of Congress. And what Ben Nelson intended as the 60th vote necessary for passage was there's no doubt that was different than Max Baucus's intent or Ron Wyden's intent, right? And so to say of congressional intent generally is something we should defer to, it opens a box that is really problematic, and I think this case helps illustrate why that is.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, it looks like we do not have a final question, or that was our final question. We've got a couple minutes left. Let me give you each a chance to wrap up. Let's go in reverse order than we did starting. So, John Baker, final thought.
Well, just on that point about intent, I mean, I think we have to distinguish between motive and intent, one, and two, intent and meaning. The words give us our meaning, and as Jonathan said, we can't really resolve intent anyway, intent or motive, because it's different for each one of them. But on the question that Jonathan addressed also about whether or not members of Congress had this or that purpose, the reality is that members of Congress read almost nothing. And I have asked senatorial staffs, some of the better ones, said, how many of these bills are read? And one of the better officers said, well, we make sure that at least one staffer in the office has read each of the bills. There's no way a member of Congress could read all of the bills. And even if one tried, it's the way they're drafted, not like many of the state statutes. So we really do not have any kind of intelligent legislative process. They rely on representations made to them by others. So when they said, if you want to keep your health care, you can do so, they were trusting Obama. And that's what happens, not just the president, but they trust those who are sponsoring the bill to tell them what it does. And if you look back at legislative history on all kinds of areas, they're almost always wrong in what they say.
Professor Adler, a final thought.
Yeah, well, just two quick things. One is, in this case, we don't actually even have a true legislative history. So there is no conference report. The usual things that advocates of legislative history like to point to don't even exist. Mike Cannon and I, or I should say more properly, a research assistant working for us, went through every reference to the word exchange in the congressional record and could not find a single instance in which any member of Congress said that under the ACA there would be tax credits available in federal exchanges. Now, again, I think you don't need to engage in that inquiry, but it's interesting that when you do it, you can't even find something like that. The last point I'd just like to make about this case is this case is very important, and if the plaintiffs win, though, it won't really be the end of the matter. It will push the issue back into the hands of the political branches. Congress may feel pressure to revise the law in one way or another. States may decide to interact with the law in a different way once the case has been decided. And that, to me, is the way it should be, in the sense that what sort of healthcare reform we have should be a function of what legislatures decide to do. And if Congress screwed up when it enacted the Affordable Care Act, then it's Congress's responsibility to fix it one way or the other.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. My thanks to both Professors Jonathan Adler and John Baker. We certainly appreciate your insights into these two very important cases, one accepted by the Supreme Court, one pending, with an announcement probably on Monday. Also, thanks to our audience for dialing in such great numbers and for such great questions. A reminder to our audience to check our website for a schedule of upcoming conference calls. But until that next conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.